This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our Sex Podcast Collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
That's me. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. It's Friday, January 17th, 2020. We're live today. I hope you've been enjoying this first month of January. It's been a little rocky, don't you think? There is a lot of shit going on in the world. We didn't have a quiet start to this new decade. And so in keeping with that theme, we're gonna talk about something that is still really sexy and fun, but is also serious tonight. Let me tell you about my guest who I'm welcoming back to the show. Robin Henderson Espinoza, PhD, has been described in a myriad of ways: a scholar activist, scholar leader, thought leader, teacher, public theologian, ethicist, poet of moral reason, and word artist. Among these ways of describing Dr. Robin, they are also a visionary thinker who spent two decades working in the borderlands of church, academy, and movements, seeking to not only disrupt but dismantle supremacy culture by focusing their PhD studies on new concepts of being and becoming, decolonizing knowledge production, and bridging with radical difference. Dr. Robin is the founder of the Activist Theology Project, a Nashville-based collaborative project that seeks to work with the dominant culture and produces curriculum at the intersection of scholarship and activism. Activist Theology is the name of their book and is a disciplinary offshoot of Liberation Theology and Movement Idea that's been incubating since 2008 with Dr. Robin and was further developed throughout their doctoral program and engagement with movement leaders. Dr. Robin was named one of 10 faith leaders to watch by the Center for American Progress in 2018, and they are a non-binary, trans, queer, Latinx person who calls Nashville home. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, Dr. Robin.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here.
So your book, Activist Theology, was published last year. I want to give people a sense of what it's all about. I mean, to me, it's a manifesto, it's a meditation, a personal story, a series of questions, dare I say it, a sermon.
Yeah.
A pathway, a book of ideas, a new vision, and a call to action. And it's a hybrid of academic and activist writing, but it's absolutely accessible to non-academics.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of, it is not a breezy beach read for those of us who can still go to the beach, which is me because I live in LA. It's heady. It's heady, and sometimes you have to like reread sections, but
yeah,
it's absolutely worth it. And I feel like anyone interested in any kind of social justice right now, whether you have a spiritual or religious path or not, can really benefit from reading it. I wanted to give people a taste of it. And so you're going to read us a little bit from the first chapter.
Yeah. So here, starting on page 2, after I spent time sitting with Cuban LGBTQIA activists, it became painfully clear that I speak a different language when it comes to activism. Not only was I lost in translation when it came to the Spanish, thankfully my most valued conversation partner was with me in translating, but I also was lost in translation when it came to thinking about social change and action. I have long called myself an intellectual activist and identify as a scholar activist, but I am not on the ground strategizing for change. My strategy happens in a different social class of movement work, and this is because I'm an intellectual. It feels important to figure out how to bridge the divides between these social classes, and I'm curious if theology and ethics and the power of imagination can facilitate a deeper connection so that change results. What feels important about the work of activist theology is that it's an attempt to make visible the connections between activism and theology. And since I believe all theology is ethics, it's my attempt to bridge together a conversation with theories and methods for greater social change. The knowledge production is not always popular education, a fact that is important to name. Furthermore, it is super important to name the ways that the specificity of knowledge production that stems from the academy is valued in ways that may or may not undermine on-the-ground work. Many years ago, I learned about the activism happening in the United States and throughout Latin America, but I learned this from a privileged position of academia and books and the internet. I didn't learn by being on the ground necessarily. Of course, I've been to protests and activist spaces, but I am most often invited into these spaces, and it's important to name that that invitation stems from privilege too. Activism preceded me. Activism and on-the-ground work have been happening for centuries as our people have been trying to get free. My work as an intellectual activist, who was trained as a constructive philosophical theologian, who is also an aspiring activist theologian, is to help organize the thoughts, methods, and actions that might help further the work of the people and bridge social institutions that have historically been disparate. It's about widening the circle, as my intellectual compañera says. And this human has been telling me the truest truths for years. I trust their wisdom. Though I have been using this term activist theology to talk about my own work and scholarship, I did not create activist theology. In many ways, activist theology is creating and recreating me.
Thanks. I love that section because I feel like it illustrates a thing that you do in this book, which is that you construct something and then you deconstruct it within pages of it.
Yeah.
It's like you show it to us and then you're like, oh, but wait, we got to break that down.
Yeah.
Even your own work, even like the very title and concept of your own work.
Right.
You are creating in this book and you're saying, I didn't create this.
Right.
Which is a really interesting juxtaposition and also not an academic thing, because academics love to own their work and sort of be the first and make up new terms. And I mean, do you feel that?
Totally. I mean, I have to say that, it takes a village for liberation to happen. And, you know, part of my story in writing this book is that when I turned in the draft in December of 2017, Fortress Press wrote back to me and said, we love your work. We want to publish your book, but this is not, like, we're not going to publish this. Because what I had turned in was the very thing that you said. It was an academic book with language that maybe five people could understand. And it was really humbling to have my publisher, you know, I had signed this contract right after I finished my PhD in 2015. And I had been working on this book for a long time. I thought this is really going to be a great book. And then to be told, hey, we want to publish this, but we're not going to publish what you turned in. And so, yeah, I mean, I had to
read. It's huge because I would say most presses who are soliciting books from academics kind of expect academic books, right?
Right. Right.
I mean, I can't see like Duke University being like, we're not publishing this. It's too academic.
Right. And so what's interesting is this is billed as an academic book. And there was a whole, like the whole academic line of Fortress Press was sold to a different company. And I fought to have my book stay with Fortress because this was really a community book. I had done a Kickstarter for this book to pay for the poetry and the trailer, the video trailer that went with it. And so it was really important for it to stay with a small press because I had really felt that the community had come behind me to support it. But then to have the publisher say, yeah, no, I was like, oh, shit, what am I going to do now? And so it was really humbling.
But also, I think, an opportunity.
Totally.
Because I didn't read the first book. Like, so I've read the result of
that. Yeah.
And I feel like it is more widely accessible. And I feel like some of the most effective books that are academic right now, in the past like 5 years, have also been accessible to regular people. I'm thinking of the first thing that comes to mind is Jack Halberstam's Gaga Feminism.
Yep.
And also Jane Ward's book, Not Gay.
Mm-hmm.
I always forget because it's about straight men who sleep with other men. So yeah. It's confusing. But I feel like that's also like the future of academic publishing is that it's got to get out to a wider audience.
Well, I guess I will say this about that. It depends, right? It depends on what kind of academic you want to be. I believe that my call and vocation is to the public square. And so if I'm not talking with real people, then it doesn't matter. I mean, the academy is self-perpetuating elitism. And so I am every day working to divest from the self-perpetuating elitism. It doesn't mean that I don't read high theory. I still do. It's my favorite stuff to read. But I'm trying to read real stuff. And years ago, my friend Tony Jones, who's an author and speaker, said to me, Robin, you've been in academia too long. You need to just go to Walmart and hang out with real people. Well, God forbid me go to Walmart. I don't shop at Walmart. But, you know, I took his advice.
Yeah. Well, I think it paid off. So we're going to take our first commercial break because we are living under capitalism and someone has to pay for the show. Let's take a break and hear from our great sponsors, including the Pleasure Chest, who I absolutely love. The word on the street is the earlier you shop for Valentine's Day, the better deal you get. So if you want to be an early bird, that's your way to go. Go to pleasurechest.com. You'll see all their specials in January and some spill over into February. Stay with us, more with Dr. Robin when we come back. Happy New Year from the Pleasure Chest. January is full of amazing pleasure ed classes, including in Los Angeles, January 22nd, Big Sex, Body Positive Sex to Empower Your Sex Life with Elle Chase. January 25th, Asian Femmes Speak Out, a panel on sexuality and stereotypes. In New York, on the Upper East Side, January 15th is a squirt shop, and January 29th is a class on pegging. At the West Village location, January 16th is Asking For It. In Chicago, January 8th, it's Suck It, Lick It, Love It, all about oral sex, and January 15th, BDSM Basics. Plus, from January 14th to the 20th, there's an early bird Valentine's Day special. You can get 20% off most popular couples toys. Some exclusions apply, online only. Beginning January 17th through February 11th, purchase any WeVibe and get a WeVibe toy bag gift in store and online. As always, go to pleasurechest.com for these deals to find out about events and to get yourself something special while you're there. Hey everyone, as Instagram deletes porn star accounts, YouTube and Facebook censor content, dating apps are full of bots. We've talked about all this on the show, and it's becoming more and more difficult for people to connect, especially intimately, online. MyGirlFund.com allows members to form virtual relationships with sexy, amazing women. On MyGirlFund.com, you can meet, message, share photos and videos, and cam with women
and in private. If you know me, you know that two of my passions are people experiencing pleasure in diverse and shame-free ways and folks getting paid fairly for their labor. It's very difficult for women to get paid for virtual adult work without risking personal exposure. Many women are willing to do dirty chat and or share nude content for money, but safe and discreet platforms are rare. My Girl Fund allows its female members to control their exposure. They connect with who they want to connect with, control how they want to interact, and decide what they want to charge for these interactions. My Girl Fund has been around since 2009, providing space for people to have intimate interactions that they want. Sign up now at mygirlfund.com and get ready to meet and make connections with women in a safe, private, adult community.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. My guest tonight is Dr. Robin Henderson Espinosa. We're talking about their new book, Activist Theology. And hey, you can call us whenever you want. Did you know that? You can give me questions, problems that you want advice on. You can talk about comments on the shows, people you want to see on the show, anything really you want within reason of being respectful. Our voicemail line is 323-SEX-8266, 323-SEX-8266. Okay, so Dr. Robin, in this book, you write a bunch about embracing radical difference and bridging difference as tools of activist theology and pathways to liberation. What I'm wondering about is the bridging difference piece. I know right now, just a lot of folks in my life are struggling with loved ones who are pro-Trump, pro-wall, pro-war. And so I want to know, sort of in practical terms, how you bridge difference with people who are so diametrically opposed to your politics.
Yeah, this is a great question. So, you know, I live in the South, and part of my journey is after the 2016 election, I left the Bay Area. I was on faculty in Berkeley. I left my faculty position and moved home to the South. And, you know, arriving here, I knew that it was the belt buckle of the Bible. And it was important for me to figure out how to be in this space as a trans queer Latinx, though one who is white passing. And I began thinking about Gloria Anzaldúa and her work around bridging and how she built coalitions in the Bay Area and really became an important figure in feminism and brought different feminist groups together. And so I began reading some of her work and reading, okay, well, how do you bridge when there are such ideological differences? And, you know, one of the things that I think we are failing to do is we're failing to be human with one another. And we let our ideologies drive us in such a way without having love, compassion, and empathy for one another. And so some of the practical ways that I do this is I have a lot of meals with conservative folks. And it's hard to hate folks when you're eating good food. And having a conversation with people and really inviting them to think about their own story and helping them restory themselves, not from the place of ideology, but from the place of love, compassion, and empathy, is one of the ways that the Activist Theology Project is bridging with difference.
It sounds great, but so challenging when I feel like some of these far-right folks wish that the people in my world and me, because of certain identity markers, you know, wish us dead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm someone who receives a fair amount of hate mail and am bullied online by people for that very reason. And I don't know what is going to help create change in this country, but I know that if we can model the kind of relationships that model the kind of world that we want to inhabit, that culture will change. It's very slow work, and it's certainly probably not something that I'm going to see in my lifetime come to fruition. But I'm committed to being different in the world and companioning people who, you know, a lot of these folks down here in the South, it's about culture, and it's, they don't want the liberal North to change their way of life, but building relationships with people who are Trump supporters, who are on the far right, I have seen people's hearts and minds changed. And I think that story is one of the technologies that can do that.
I mean, I love this idea of meals and of story, because another thread that runs throughout the book is this idea of the importance of human connection.
Right.
And you really argue that it's, you know, it's what's missing, and it's also something that could save us.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm anti-capitalist, I should say. And so what capitalism has done is force us into a type of relating patterns, which are based in transactions. What can I get from you? People email me all the time, hey, can you introduce me to this person, without any real relationship to it. Now, I'm happy to introduce people to people. I'm happy to network. That's fine. I'm happy to help people connect to other people, but we can do that in a more relational way. And so what I advocate for the book is a different kind of relationality, which I think queers have been doing for a long time. And so queers can really model this kind of relationality, this kind of liberative relationality, to the larger world in the face of the homo normalizing that is being done by things like marriage equality and so forth.
I mean, it seems like a lot of oppressive systems are like conspiring to shut down rather than cultivate human connection.
Right.
And I think part of this is also a problem of the internet and the ways that we interact online, which are devoid of compassion and in some cases, humanity.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the thing that I hate the most is the one-line tweet that basically shuts down the conversation. There's no humanity in that. And so what I'm trying to advocate is a new humanity, a more humane humanity. And I think the fact that you're having me on your show and we're having this conversation is part of that work. I think that we need to be having this conversation all across the country. And I think that we need to figure out how best to bridge the divide. I mean, we can see how polarized the political scene is right now.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so that is based in a transactional relationality, not a relationality that is geared toward liberation. And so if we can reorient ourselves toward liberation and freedom, which includes abolishing some systems,
mm-hmm.
Then maybe we can see culture shift. But, you know, until we commit to a different kind of relationality as a culture, we'll still be, we'll remain in these silos where it's an us against them, an oppositional relationality.
But I think another piece of liberation is people who are at the top of the hierarchy and who have the most power have to be willing to give up something.
Yes.
And how do we convince folks that we all have a stake in this liberation when people who are sort of white and rich and upper middle class feel like I'm good? What's everyone complaining about?
Well, this is about the sort of hyper-individualism that capitalism breeds, but also, can we have a real conversation about poverty? What I call in the book our greatest social violence, which mm-hmm. is poverty. there's not yet been a presidential debate on poverty. And if we can figure out how to have a conversation about poverty and how we have created a political economy and an economic system that privileges a few and marginalizes the majority, I mean, like, we need to have that conversation. And so until we begin to have those conversations, I mean, some of those conversations are happening in communities, but we need to be able to have those conversations with institutions, with political people who are making decisions on the economy and on who gets what food stamps and who doesn't. Until we're able to have those conversations, I don't know that we're going to be able to change people's mindset. And the reality is that rich white people, mostly who are men, they're not invested in any sort of change. And so it's left to women, people of color, and other marginalized people to do the labor. We also need to address that. Who's doing the labor of this stuff?
Right. Right. Well, and also it strikes me that, I mean, there's so much intertwined in there too. I think a huge piece of homelessness and poverty in Los Angeles is about the criminal justice system, and also about lack of mental health care.
Right. I mean, we criminalize the homeless.
Yeah.
And we criminalize those who are living with different mental health experiences. That is also part of the problem of poverty. And so this is a very large conversation that many of us are trying to have. And thankfully, I have gotten into some of the political campaigns and I'm asking some of these people to come on to my new podcast to have these conversations, because the people want to know. People want to know, like, what are you going to do about the marginalized people, the people who are most impacted by the decisions that are made by rich white folks that severely marginalize even myself, right? I mean, I talk about being one paycheck away from being on the streets, and that's a reality for the majority of people in this country.
Yeah, exactly. Because these so-called institutions, which are supposed to support us, actually work against most of us, but work for some of the people.
Right. That's right. A very small minority of the people.
This also reminds me, if anyone out there ever, ever, ever has the opportunity to go to a class on undoing racism. So there's it's in the South, actually, an organization called the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. And twice now I've seen one of the originators of the framework and then someone else use the framework to talk about poorness and poverty, and it is just spectacular. So if you ever hear of that at any of your functions or in any of your community organizations, run, don't walk.
Yes.
If you can run. We're going to take another break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about activist theology. We're going to talk about justice and struggle, and also the sort of personal parts that Robin puts in their story, which make it different from the sort of average manifesto. Stay with us. Hi, everyone. You may have heard me talking about Erica Lust's new adult film studio, Lust Cinema, over the past few months. Well, this is your final call, people, because you only have 2 weeks left to enjoy the introductory offer of just $5 for 1 month. $5. Go to lustcinema.com/Tristan and pay $5 to access a whole catalog of adult films, as well as performer interviews and behind-the-scenes footage so that you can get a closer look at your favorite stars. There are no extra fees or hidden costs, and you can cancel at any time. On the site, you'll find Lust Cinema original feature-length films and original series shot by Erica Lust, and plenty of other female directors, as well as a huge catalog of licensed content.
Just like Erica's work, you're not going to find any reductive casting of performers. There's no boring porn stereotypes and no damaging fetishization. Just very hot sex. Equal pleasure, believable storylines, and cinematic quality. So if you want to experience everything that Lust Cinema has to offer for just $5, go to lustcinema.com/Tristan now.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com. You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking today with the author of Activist Theology. It's Dr. Robin Henderson Espinosa. Robin, you include a lot of, not a lot, but enough personal stories in this to really kind of get a sense of who you are and kind of locate you. That's another reason why I think it's more accessible than the average academic thing, where you're supposed to just be like floating above, not in a body. And another theme that I picked up, and I don't know if you name it this particular word, but it's what came up for me, is this sense of belonging.
Yep.
And how you are between worlds in so many different ways. And I wondered if we could talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of what breaks my heart, living in between worlds and not really being accepted in any one world. You know, I'm not dark enough, unless I'm speaking Spanish. See, this is the weird thing. Unless I'm speaking Spanish, I'm not really accepted by the Latinx community. When white folks find out that I'm mixed race, that I'm fetishized, you know, as a non-binary person, as a person who has decided that no, I don't want to be male or a man, and no, I don't identify as being female. You know, they're, you know, finding belonging and opting out of the gender binary has created, you know, lots of heartbreak. And then, of course, on some level, leaving the academy, as I have done, even though I still have a visiting post at Duke and a visiting scholar at Vanderbilt, I'm not a traditional academic. And so living between the worlds of academia and activism and not being accepted by either really is a real heartbreak. And so I learned to build my village and build my community in creative and innovative ways. And that has taken a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And so I try to write about that.
But you also do some nice self-examination. And you actually make a case for being a sort of a conduit and bridge yourself. Like, I found myself thinking after this, okay, the folks who don't fit in the binary, who don't fit in the boxes, are actually the ones who are poised to bridge these differences.
Yeah, but we need to be careful about saying that, because there's a lot of, certainly people of color and non-binary people who are tired of being bridges, who are tired of being the backs over which people walk.
Like the laborers.
And so I do feel, I mean, I talk about this in therapy with my therapist, about, I really do feel like I'm a bridge in lots of ways. And also, I am a person that is legitimated in some circumstances or in some places, and then delegitimated in other places. And so while I am a bridge, I'm also in between space in lots of ways, which there's a Nahuatl word for that. It is Nepatla. And so it is that term gets translated as middle space or as being neither nor both and. And so I really feel like in lots of ways I am a Nepatlera or Nepatletex, and being in between it, for me, is a fruitful place, but I don't want to put that on other people, because I know that there are a lot of people who contest that, who are tired of being in the middle place and being the connector for people.
So you want people to choose it themselves and self-identify.
Yeah, I mean, this is, for me, this is how I feel and where I feel like my work is, bridging the divides between academia and activism. But I know that's not for everyone. And I also know that I say that with a lot of privilege as being masculine presenting, as have one with a PhD, you know, and I get legitimated to in order to say that. And so, yeah, I want people to use their agency to self-identify. And also, I feel like I'm a bridge.
You mentioned Gloria Anzaldúa, before the break or in one of the segments. Yep. I just want to catch people up for those of you who don't know. Gloria Anzaldúa was a Chicana lesbian, and which is an identity claimed by Mexican Americans living in the United States. She was a scholar and queer feminist woman of color theory, probably most well known for co-editing the book This Bridge Called My Back. We're back on bridges. Writing by radical women of color, which is a seminal feminist of color text. And you refer to her a couple times in the book. What about her work most resonates with you?
Well, I mean, she wrote this very powerful book that was published in 1987 by Antelope Press called Borderlands, The New Mestiza. And it was a book that I read probably 2.5 decades ago when I was in seminary living in Chicago. And my advisor at the time, the teacher, the person who wrote the foreword to the book, in fact, Nancy, she was the one who recommended that book to me. And it was the book that really opened my eyes to what it meant to be a mixed race person, specifically born to a Mexican woman, not of this country, and an Anglo man, and what it meant to have brown blood in me and what it meant to have the colonizer's blood in me. And that book, Borderlands, is, I mean, I go back to it time and time again. It's the book that I think gave me life and showed me that there was a way that I could live my life as this borderland person without capitulating to institutional norms.
Okay, so I don't know how to make a transition to this part, but one of my worst fears came true in reading this book.
Okay.
As someone who doesn't subscribe to Christianity.
Yep.
Jesus.
Yep.
Jesus is in here.
Yeah.
Tell me about, I mean, my first thought was, okay, I'm just going to read this and not feel alienated about it. But all of a sudden I was like, oh my God, they're a religious scholar. I forgot. They know all these stories of Jesus. But like, how do you make sense of Jesus with alongside all of these other ideas? Because to me, like the way that Jesus has been co-opted and like, this is a bad word, but branded as a white guy and as the person who died for our sins and all this shit is very alienating to me.
Yeah. So I try to do some of that work when I write about Jesus. And I have to be really honest. And this is where I'm sure most of my audience isn't listening to this show, but so much of my audience, you know, like 90% of my audience are white liberal progressive Christians. And I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time. And I keep collecting these people who follow me and who want to know more. And so I felt like for my audience, it was important for me to write about Jesus in a way that reclaimed who he was, that he was... He was poor flesh. He was brown flesh. He's not the white toxic Jesus that Christian nationalists tout. And so I felt like I couldn't leave that out. And also, that's the tradition that has socialized me in deep ways. And, you know, I have 3 degrees in theology, so I felt like I had to write something about it in a way that my audience could understand. And so many folks who follow me are people who have left the evangelical church but still want to have a faith. And so this is an opportunity for them to be able to claim something without having to leave everything when they leave. And so I felt like I was trying to be loyal to my audience and a faithful theologian who does the hard work of saying, you know, bad theology kills. And there's so much toxic theology running around. It's showing up in our government as people write policies. So I really felt like writing about Jesus was harm reduction. And it's the thing that I try to do. I talk about theology being harm reduction. And if we can tell a better story about Jesus, then maybe we can reduce the harm that is killing our friends.
Okay, I want to talk more about harm reduction, but we are going to take another commercial break.
Okay.
Don't go anywhere, people. This is getting really good. We've already heard what they talk about with their therapist. When we come back, we're going to talk more about activist theology and specifically harm reduction. So come right back. Happy New Year from the Pleasure Chest. January is full of amazing Pleasure Ed classes, including in Los Angeles, January 22nd, Big Sex, Body Positive Sex to Empower Your Sex Life with Elle Chase. January 25th, Asian Femmes Speak Out, a panel on sexuality and stereotypes. In New York, on the Upper East Side, January 15th is a squirt shop, and January 29th is a class on pegging. At the West Village location, January 16th is Asking For It. In Chicago, January 8th, it's Suck It, Lick It, Love It, all about oral sex, and January 15th, BDSM Basics. Plus, from January 14th to the 20th, there's an early bird Valentine's Day special. You can get 20% off most popular couples toys. Some exclusions apply, online only. Beginning January 17th through February 11th, purchase any WeVibe and get a WeVibe toy bag gift in-store and online. As always, go to pleasurechest.com for these deals, to find out about events, and to get yourself something special while you're there.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, the show's almost over, and I almost forgot to tell you that I'm going to be live and in person in Albuquerque, New Mexico next week at Self Serve, which is a great sex positive feminist sex shop and community space. I'm teaching two classes in one day on January 25th. It's a Saturday at 3:00. I am co-teaching perimenopause, menopause, and pleasure with fellow sex educator Elle Chase. And then at 7:30, I'm talking about making open relationships work. So you can go to my website on the tour page. You can go to my social media, and there are links for how to get tickets. So I hope I see some of you next week in New Mexico. Okay, so we're back with Robin Henderson Espinosa, Dr. Robin is what I like to call them, and activist theology. So before the break, you brought up harm reduction, and that was something I wanted to talk about it. One of the very first things I learned about you, people may recall I met Dr. Robin at Sex Down South three or four years ago.
It's been a while.
It's 2015.
2015, I think.
Okay, so 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And one of the first things you said to me was I do theology as harm reduction.
Yeah.
And it was one of those moments where I just sort of paused, because in the sex education field, we use the term harm reduction to mean, yeah, like, instead of a model of abstinence or just say no or just don't do that, which we know doesn't work for people, we instead become curious and say, okay, so these are the kinds of sex you're having. Rather than judging or shaming or proclaiming don't do it, what are some of the ways we can reduce your risks of acquiring or transmitting an STI? And it comes from the world of drug use disorders, actually. Right. So for it was really designed for different treatment options for people who use alcohol and drugs. So you say to me, you know, I do theology as harm reduction, and you talk about this in the book, and I want to know more.
Yeah, you know, I feel like there is a lot of toxic shit in the world that comes from religious narratives, in particular the Christian church. And you know, I say this all the time. I never come out as a Christian because it equals white supremacy. And I think white supremacy is causing a lot of harm in the country. And so my job as a person who is anti-racist and anti-capitalist is to do theology as harm reduction. And what I mean by that is trying to cast new narratives around theology and ethics. I mean, the other thing is I believe all theology is ethics. And so when we break that down, what I mean is I don't care what you believe. I care about your politics.
Are your politics what you believe?
Well, your politics will tell me what you believe. Yes.
Hmm. And you don't mean you don't care about your beliefs. You care about your actions.
Right.
Yes?
Exactly.
No.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yes. Okay.
You know, so when we look at our actions, how we treat people, where we buy our food, where we buy our coffee, like if we're going to Starbucks every day to buy our coffee, then that is something that I feel concerned about, because what are we doing when we are going to Starbucks and supporting that institution? Is that creating more harm?
Yes.
Or is that not? And so I don't mean for it to be a litmus test, but I do want to be very serious with people that it's how we treat people, and it's our actions in the world that are either going to make us or break us.
Well, it also feels like you're saying along the lines of the harm reduction theory that you're not ready to throw out all religion, right? So some people's reaction to the sort of white supremacy within the Christian church or churches is so toxic that they're just like, I'm done.
Right.
And you are attempting to sort of rescue parts of it and hang on to parts of it. Would you say that?
Well, this is what I would say. I would say that humanity is deeply invested in meaning making. And religion is one of the ways that folks have tried to make meaning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Ritual is a way that people make meaning. And there are lots of different rituals. There are rituals that are in a cathedral, or rituals that are around a bonfire, or rituals that are at a river. And so what I am trying to do in the work of activist theology is say, you can do your ritual. It doesn't have to cause harm. And your practices, they don't have to cause harm. If they are causing harm, that's bad theology.
Hmm. Well, but this brings to mind the question of when people are sort of have all their different interpretations of the Bible.
Yeah.
And they're like, the Bible says this definitively. And then someone else says, no, the Bible says this. And people argue about that a lot. So
now we're getting into, you know, who has the right interpretation of the Bible. And mm-hmm. I'm not concerned about that. I mean, I get very wary of people who, and they're called inerrantists, people who believe there are no errors in the Bible. Mm. Like, it's a fucking, you know, like, human-made book of stories. Of course there are mistakes, you know? And it was canonized by a group of powerful men. So it's a patriarchal text. So, but I'm not a Bible scholar. I only have theological comments about the Bible. But I guess my point is if you want to argue about the Bible, we can argue about the Bible, but the Bible was written in a particular time and context, and there is a particular story that goes along with every book of the Bible, right? It's there are certain players in the book, there are certain power structures, and we all have to take that into consideration when thinking about the Bible. Also, did you ever think that you would be talking about the Bible on your show?
You're not the first person I talked about the Bible, because I did have these folks on who are conservative Christians, and they were in a documentary, which I think was about Jesus and sex. I don't remember what it was called, but so I have talked about Jesus, but no, really, no. or the Bible. Okay, we've only got a few minutes left. I guess I want from you there's like calls to action at the end of all the chapters.
Yeah.
And I know that people are struggling to figure out what to do in the world right now, which it can be incapacitating. It's so overwhelming. All the destruction, all the violence, all the oppression, all the killing. Like, it's just sometimes you're like stuck, you're frozen.
Yeah.
So like, what are some things we can do or think about doing, getting ready to do, that will contribute to a collective liberation?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that we need to get clear about is we have an election in November. And I think that we need to be doing everything that we can do to, you know, vote Trump out. And that means talking to your neighbors, talking to your friends and family about what kind of president you want. Like, what does that look like for folks? And then, of course, to make sure folks are registered to vote. The other thing that I would say is story is so powerful. And if we can begin to tell our stories to one another and begin to restory ourselves in a way that points toward liberation, that will also create culture change. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we're doing the film, The Front Porch. It's my story of leaving the Bay Area and moving to the South. And we interview people all across the country on my drive back to the South, so that we can collect a multiplicity of voices to tell the story about what it means to live in the South. We need to be telling stories to each other. We need to be talking to each other.
Also, people can support that film on Kickstarter. Hey, Raymond, will you tweet out a link to the Kickstarter so folks can support that on the front porch?
It's actually Seed and Spark.
It's Seed and Spark. There's crowdfunding going on.
Yeah.
And Raymond's going to tweet that for me just right on the spot.
Great.
Because his mind is a computer.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show and talking about this. Like you said, this is not your typical place where you are invited to speak and come to speak. And this is not a typical show for me, but I feel like my listeners are really going to appreciate it. And I appreciate you.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
So if you want to learn more about Robin Henderson Espinosa, you can go to irobin.com, irobyn.com, and activisttheology.com. On Twitter and Instagram, they are at irobin, and on Facebook, they're Robin Henderson Espinosa. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible: executive producer Karen Dana, senior producer Raymond Johnson, announcer Cooper Beckett from Life on the Swing Set, Andrew, my engineer, and everyone at Voice America. Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the show. Raymond and I are going to be talking about sex on television. So if you want to hear our takes on some of our favorite shows, who's doing it really well and who's doing it really badly, let me give you a hint. I absolutely love Sex Education, and I absolutely love Work in Progress. So we're going to talk about that. And if one of us watches Euphoria, that'll be in there too. In the meantime, you can catch me on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm at Tristan Taramino, and before you see me or talk to me again, take some time to talk about sex and also about theology and activism out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.